My first sight of England was Dover on a foggy March night in 1973, when I arrived on the midnight ferry from Calais at the tender age of 21. Taking the midnight ferry was a huge mistake. I spent a miserable night attempting to sleep on a freezing bench. I don't remember the name of the guest house that I found the next morning. It actually turned out to be a boarding house, but I well recall the proprietress, a formidable creature of late middle years called Mrs. Smegma, who showed me to a room, then gave me a tour of the facilities and outlined the many complicated rules for residing there, when breakfast was served, how to turn on the heater for the bath, which hours of the day I would have to vacate the premises, and during which brief period a bath was permitted. These seemed oddly to coincide. How much notice I should give if I intended to receive a phone call or remain out after 10 p.m., how to flush the loo and use the loo brush, which materials were permitted in the bedroom wastebasket and which had to be carefully conveyed to the outside dustbin, where and how to wipe my feet at each point of entry, how to operate the 3-bar fire in my bedroom, and when that would be permitted, essentially during an ice age. This was all bewilderingly new to me. Where I came from, you got a room in a hotel, spent 10 hours making a lavish and possibly irredeemable mess of it, and left early the next morning. This was like joining the army.
"The minimum stay," Mrs. Smegma went on, "is 5 nights at £1 a night, including full English breakfast."
5 nights? I said in a small gasp. I'd only intended to stay the one. What on earth was I going to do with myself in Dover for 5 days? Mrs. Smegma arched an eyebrow.
"Were you hoping to stay longer?"
"No," I said. "No, as a matter—"
"Good, because we have a party of Scottish pensioners coming for the weekend, and it would have been awkward. Actually, quite impossible."
She surveyed me critically, as she might do a carpet stain, while I nodded dumbly. And, with that, she slammed the thin bedroom door and was gone. I stood there, feeling lost and weary and far from home. Suddenly the door reopened, and Mrs. Smegma was striding across the room to the strip light above the sink. She had shown me the correct method for turning it on.
"There's no need to yank it. A gentle tug is sufficient."
And evidently remembered that she had left it burning. She turned it off now, with what seemed to me a sharp yank, then gave me and the room a final suspicious once-over, and departed again. When I was sure she was quite gone, I quietly locked the door, drew shut the curtains, had a pee in the sink, and took my leave. After spending a satisfying and illuminating day in Dover, I'd intended to turn in early, but on the way to my room I noticed a door marked Residence Lounge and put my head in. It was a large parlor with easy chairs and a settee, all with starched antimacassars, a bookcase with a modest selection of jigsaw puzzles and paperback books, an occasional table with some well-thumbed magazines, and a large color television. I switched on the TV and looked through the magazines while I waited for it to warm up. They were all women's magazines, but they weren't like the magazines my mother and sister read. The articles in my mother's and sister's magazines were always about sex and personal gratification. They had titles like, "Eat Your Way to Multiple Orgasms," "Office Sex, How to Get It," "Tahiti, the Hot New Place for Sex," and "Those Shrinking Rainforests, Are They Any Good for Sex?" The British magazines addressed more modest aspirations. They had titles like, "Knit Your Own Twin Set," "Money-Saving Button Offer," "Make this super knitted soap saver," and "Summer's here, it's time for mayonnaise." The program that unfolded on the television was called Jason King. If you're of a certain age and lacked a social life on Friday evenings in the early 70s, you may recall that it involved a ridiculous rake in a puffy caftan whom women unaccountably appeared to find alluring. I couldn't decide whether to take hope from this or be depressed by it. The most remarkable thing about the program was that, though I saw it only once more than 20 years ago, I have never lost the desire to work the fellow over with a baseball bat studded with nails. Toward the end of the program, another resident came in, carrying a bowl of steaming water and a towel. He said, "Oh," in surprise when he saw me, and took a seat by the window. He was thin and red-faced, and filled the room with a smell of liniment. He looked like someone with unhealthy sexual ambitions, the sort of person your P.E. teacher warned that you would turn into if you masturbated too extravagantly, someone, in short, like your P.E. teacher. He looked stealthily at me, then covered his head with the towel, and lowered his face to the bowl where it remained for much of the rest of the evening. A few minutes later, a bald-headed middle-aged guy, a shoe salesman I would have guessed, came in and said, "Hello," to me, and "Evening, Richard," to the toweled head, and took a seat beside me. Shortly after that, we were joined by an older man with a walking stick, a dicky leg, and a gruff manner. He looked darkly at us all, nodded the most tinily precise of acknowledgments, and fell heavily into his seat, where he spent the next 20 minutes maneuvering his leg this way and that, as if positioning a heavy piece of furniture. I gathered that these people were all long-term residents. A sitcom came on, called My Neighbor is a Darkie. I suppose that wasn't its actual title, but that was the gist of it, that there was something richly comic in the notion of having black people living next door. It was full of lines like, "Good Lord, Gran, there's a coloured chappie in your cupboard," and, "Well, I couldn't see you in the dark, could I?" It was hopelessly moronic. The bald-headed guy beside me laughed until he was wiping tears from his eyes, and from under the towel there came occasional snorts of amusement. But the colonel, I noticed, never laughed. He simply stared at me, as if trying to remember what dark event from his past I was associated with. Every time I looked over, his eyes were fixed on me. It was unnerving. A starburst briefly filled the screen, indicating an interval of adverts, which the bald-headed man used to quiz me in a friendly but confusingly disconnected way as to who I was and how I had fallen into their lives. He was delighted to find that I was American. "I've always wanted to see America," he said to me. "Tell me, do you have Woolworths there?" Well, actually, Woolworths is American. "You don't say! Do you hear that, Colonel? Woolworths is American!" The Colonel seemed unmoved by this intelligence. "And what about cornflakes?" I beg your pardon? "Do you have cornflakes in America?" "Well, actually, they're American, too."
"Never!"
I smiled weakly and begged my legs to stand me up and take me out of there, but my lower body seemed oddly inert.
"Fancy! So, what brings you to Britain, then, if you have cornflakes already?"
I looked at him to see if the question was serious, then embarked reluctantly and falteringly on a brief resume of my life to that point, but after a moment I realized that the program had restarted, and he wasn't even pretending to listen, so I tailed off, and instead spent the whole of part two absorbing the heat of the colonel's glare. When the program finished, I was about to hoist myself from the chair and bid this happy trio a warm adieu when the door opened and Mrs. Smegma came in with a tray of tea things and a plate of biscuits of the sort that I believe are called tea time variety, and everyone stirred friskily to life, rubbing their hands keenly and saying, "Ooh, lovely!" To this day I remain impressed by the ability of Britons of all ages and social backgrounds to get genuinely excited by the prospect of a hot beverage.
"And how was the world of birds tonight, Colonel?"
asked Mrs. Smegma, as she handed the Colonel a cup of tea and a biscuit.
"Couldn't say," said the Colonel archly. "The television,"
he smacked me in the side of the head with a meaningful look,
"was tuned to the other side."
Mrs. Smegma gave me a sharp look, too, in sympathy. I think they were sleeping together.
"World of birds is the Colonel's favorite,"
she said to me in a tone that went some distance past hate, and handed me a cup of tea with a hard, whitish biscuit. I mewed some pitiful apology.
"It was puffins tonight,"
blurted the red-faced fellow, looking very pleased with himself. Mrs. Smegma stared at him for a moment, as if surprised to find out that he had the power of speech.
"Puffins?"
she said, and gave me a still more withering expression that asked how anyone could be so lacking in fundamental human decency.
"The Colonel adores puffins, don't you, Arthur?"
She was definitely sleeping with him.
"I do, rather,"
said the Colonel, biting unhappily into a chocolate bourbon. In shame, I sipped my tea and nibbled my biscuit. I had never had tea with milk in it before, or a biscuit of such rock-like cheerlessness. It tasted like something you would give a budgie to strengthen its beak. After a minute, the bald-headed guy leaned close to me and in a confiding whisper said,
"You mustn't mind the Colonel. He hasn't been the same since he lost his leg."
"Well, I hope for his sake that he soon finds it," I replied, hazarding a little sarcasm. The bald-headed guy guffawed at this, and for one terrifying moment I thought he was going to share my little quip with the Colonel and Mrs. Smegma, but instead he thrust a meaty hand at me and introduced himself. I don't remember his name now, but it was one of those names that only English people have. Colin Crapspray, or Bertram Panty Shield, or something similarly improbable. I gave a crooked smile, thinking he must be pulling my leg, and said, "You're kidding."
"Not at all," he replied coldly. "Why, do you find it amusing?"
"Well, it's just that it's kind of unusual."
"Well, you may think so,"
he said, and turned his attention to the Colonel and Mrs. Smegma, and I realized that I was now, and would doubtless forever remain, friendless in Dover. Over the next 2 days, Mrs. Smegma persecuted me mercilessly, while the others, I suspected, scouted evidence for her. She reproached me for not turning the light off in my room when I went out, for not putting the lid down in the toilet when I'd finished, for taking the Colonel's hot water. I'd no idea he had his own until he started rattling the doorknob and making aggrieved noises in the corridor. for ordering the full English breakfast 2 days running and then leaving the fried tomato both times.
"I see you've left the fried tomato again," she said on the second occasion.
I didn't know quite what to say to this, as it was incontestably true, so I simply furrowed my brow and joined her in staring at the offending item. I had actually been wondering for 2 days what it was.
"May I request," she said in a voice heavy with pain and years of irritation, "that in future, if you don't require a fried tomato with your breakfast, that you would be good enough to tell me?"
Abashed, I watched her go. "I thought it was a blood clot," I wanted to yell after her, but of course I said nothing, and merely skulked from the room to the triumphant beams of my fellow residents. After that, I stayed out of the house as much as I could. Within the house, I tried to remain silent and inconspicuous. I even turned over quietly in my creaking bed, but no matter how hard I tried, I seemed fated to annoy. On the third afternoon, as I crept in, Mrs. Smegma confronted me in the hallway with an empty cigarette packet and demanded to know if it was I who had thrust it in the privet hedge. I began to understand why innocent people sign extravagant confessions in police stations. That evening I forgot to turn off the water heater after a quick and stealthy bath, and compounded the error by leaving strands of hair in the plug hole. The next morning came the final humiliation. Mrs. Smegma marched me wordlessly to the toilet and showed me a little turd that had not flushed away. We agreed that I should leave after breakfast. I caught a fast train to London and have not been back to Dover since. Flash forward 20 years or so. It's 1994, and I've decided to return to live in America so that my kids can experience life in my native land, and my wife can shop until 10 p.m. 7 nights a week. Before we go, I decide to take a final look around the country that I have honestly grown to love. I start, briefly, in London. Goodness me, but isn't London big? It seems to start about 20 minutes after you leave Dover, and just goes on and on. Mile after mile of endless gray suburbs with their wandering ranks of terraced houses and stuccoed semis that always look more or less identical from a train, as if they've been squeezed out of a very large version of one of those machines they used to make sausages. How, I always wonder, do all the millions of occupants find their way back to the right boxes each night in such a complex and anonymous sprawl? I'm sure I couldn't. London remains a vast and exhilarating mystery to me. It constantly amazes me to read the Evening Standard or chat with an acquaintance and encounter some reference to a district that has managed to elude my ken for 21 years.
"We've just bought a little place in Fag End, near Tungsten Heath," somebody will say, and I'll think, "I've never even heard of that place. How can this possibly be?"
I had stuck a London A to Z in my rucksack and came across it now while searching unsuccessfully for half a Mars bar that I was sure was in there somewhere. Plucking it out, I idly leafed through its busy pages, as ever, amazed and quietly excited to find it peppered with districts, villages, sometimes small, swallowed cities, whose names, I would swear, had not been there the last time I looked. And the thing is, I know that the next time I look, there will be other, different names. It is as deep a mystery to me as the lost tablets of Titianca, or the continuing appeal to millions of Noel Edmonds. Anyhow, I spent a couple of days in London doing nothing much. I did a little research at a newspaper library, spent most of one afternoon trying to find my way through the complex network of pedestrian subways at Marble Arch, did a little shopping, saw some friends. Everyone I saw said, "Gosh, you're brave," when I revealed that I was planning to travel around Britain by public transport, but it never occurred to me to go any other way. You're so lucky in this country to have a relatively good public transport system, and I think we should all try harder to enjoy it, while it's still there. Besides, driving in Britain is such a dreary experience. My thoughts on that, and much, much more, tomorrow.